The Friday Reporter launched in March of 2021 as a conversation with today's journalists and has expanded to include newsmakers, lawmakers, image makers, and just about anybody who's in the news or the news adjacent business. The podcast is in partnership with PR Daily and is part of the Big Wig Podcast Network. If you like the show, please hit the subscribe button to make sure you've got ready access to the latest conversation. And if you've got an idea for a great guest, don't forget to send your ideas to Lisa at FridayReporter.com. Well, hello, and thank you so much for joining me for another episode of the Friday Reporter podcast. Today's guest is a guest you will recognize from her time here in Washington, D.C. Beth Sidhu is Chief Brand and Communications Officer for Stagwell and has a remarkable background in the intersection between business, news, and politics. And Beth, I'm just thrilled to have you with me today.
Thank you for having me, Lisa. It's great to be here.
So Beth, tell me a little bit about your pathway to get to Stagwell, because I know that you spent quite a bit of time in the early days at Politico and some of our other networks and other broadcast places that we know about. So I want you to tell me that story a little bit and how you got to be where you are today.
Sure. Well, like many people, I read Katharine Graham's autobiography, publisher of The Post, and fell in love with the idea of Washington and the idea of journalism. And I decided I wanted to be a political journalist. So I went to the George Washington University as an undergrad and was very lucky to have some internships, including at CBS News. And when I came back from graduate school, I lucked into a job as a political producer for CBS. And at that stage, you got to do all the shows. So I got to work on evening news in the morning on all the pieces. And from there, I went to actually work for Mark Penn, who I work for now. There are many stops along the way, but I worked for Mark working on the Tony Blair campaign, then at Penn Schoen Berland, which was the polling firm. And one of the things I did at Penn Schoen Berland was events, and I did a couple with Politico. And one day someone from Politico reached out and said, you know, we're starting an events division. Do you know anyone who might be good for it? And I, after talking to a friend, raised my hand and I went to Politico and started the events division there. I guess I was there 5-6 years.
That's amazing.
And then I came to Stagwell when it was just three people in a conference room.
Oh, you're kidding. Wow, that's amazing. And so much has changed since you, when you started that, when Politico started that effort to do the events, that was cutting edge. That was brand new activity here in Washington, D.C. There were others that were doing small other, but you really broke the mold. No question about it. When that hit the scene, everyone really was sort of changing their model about how to make money, how to do business, and how to really make journalism a different animal, really. I mean, and that's the only way I can put it. And so much has changed since that's happened. There have been so many other new publications that have come on the scenes. There are some that are still doing similar models. They continue to reinvent and change all the time. Talk to me a little bit about the philosophy then and sort of how that's changed for folks who don't necessarily know a lot about that side of the business.
So the mandate at Politico was incredibly simple. It was win the morning and have every story that anyone in politics wanted to read. And that actually extended to events. It was win the morning with events as journalism. You know, John Harris and Jim Vandehei, backed, I should say, really importantly by Robert Allbritton, had crystal clear vision. They attacked it every day. And the number one goal for our events was to make news. And if you approach them that way, then actually what we found is the people who wanted to sponsor them, wanted to be part of them, would follow because they were interesting, they were differentiated, and it was never really a choice between making money or making news. The mandate was always make the news and the dollars will follow. I'm not sure if that's true of every publication. It certainly was of Politico, and it was a great place to be, and I got to sort of wear two hats, a little on the journalism side and a little on the business side.
And it was always, It was really, at least then, I was working for a campaign, an issue campaign, and you'll remember this because you and I worked together a little bit at that time, where we were really trying to make news and affect change and talk about, we wanted to be the conversation over the water cooler as the day started in the office space, right? And I think that that's a lot of what was happening. You guys were having early events, getting people out the door early in the morning, start the conversation. The morning newsletters, a lot of times, depending on the issue that was coming out of that particular event, whether it was energy or healthcare or technology, always really drove the conversation in the newsletters, and therefore everyone else chased those stories all day long. And I'm not sure that that model is the same anymore because there are so many events. It's impossible to really, and I think COVID probably changed that a lot too for the way where that work is done. But I think also too, people aren't necessarily attending events and doing their business the way they were at that time when you were at Politico.
You know, it's been, I won't tell you how many years, but it's been enough years that I'm certain things have changed. What I think hasn't changed and what absolutely is true of what I do now and what I think worked about Politico is that people want something different if they are going to spend their time on it.
Yeah.
If you can get it from any source, if you can find it on any page, proverbial or otherwise, you probably won't bother. And so what made Politico work and what makes what we're doing at Stagwell and specifically in things like Sport Beach or with our risk and reputation practice is they are different and you cannot find them anywhere else. And that's really hard. It's actually much easier to sort of ride the wave or do just a little bit different of what some other people are doing. But John and Jim at Politico and Mark Penn today at Stagwell, you know, that if other people are doing it, let's not just do the same thing.
Sure. And that's why, that's really why our conversation is happening today, because I'm so curious about, in particular, I'd like to talk about Sport Beach because this is really sort of a new, smart, revolutionary product and event. It's really an experience to me based on the research and the understanding I have about it. Talk to me a little bit about the genesis of that and the CAN event that it's in coordination with.
Yeah, so let me set the scene for you. CAN Lions International Festival of Creativity happens every June in Cannes, France, and it is the Super Bowl for advertising and marketing. It is the, you know, DNC, RNC convention for a campaign all rolled into one.
Wow.
And our insight in looking at it was that you had thousands, really tens of thousands of people attending this event every year. But over time, it had gotten homogenized. Mm-hmm. And the only way that agencies or brands were differentiating was star power. So someone would invite Gwyneth Paltrow to do yoga, or someone would invite Lizzo to sing, or, you know, Ryan Reynolds to talk about, you know, his latest movie. And there's all of those events were interesting and different. But what we realized it left out was the only appointment viewing left in the world, the global, diverse and influential audience that loves sport. Mm. So when we were figuring out how we would show up at our Super Bowl, rather than do Stagwell Beach, which would have been the obvious choice, mm-hmm. We decided to do Sport Beach and to lean into an audience and really focus on something that would be differentiated, transformative, and would provide people with an option at this great event to do something they hadn't had a chance to do before.
And it really, from the looks of what was happening last year and then perhaps what's already sort of been leaked out a little bit from what this year will look like, is that it's there's specific curated events inside of the Sport Beach experience. Is that right? So there's specific sports celebrities that will be doing and hosting a variety of different experiences.
So the idea with Sport Beach is that it is a platform to explore sport, but really the conversations that sport starts. So yes, you want to talk about what happens on the court or the field or, you know, what have you, but actually sport is just the door we're walking through. Mm-hmm. So for lots of people, sport is politics, it's innovation, it's global reach, it's new audiences. And so sport is how we get people to come and pay attention to what we're doing. But then we take seriously the idea of athletes as strategists, business people, content creators, and put them side by side on equal footing with marketers to talk about how sport and marketing are working together. if you think about it, as I said, it's the only appointment viewing left in the world. But, you know, we've got athletes who are doing incredible things on and off the court. And if we take them seriously in that way and connect them with the interesting, serious, and sometimes fun work that we are all doing as marketers, it's a different mix. It just doesn't exist anywhere else. And that's what we've leaned into starting last year. And this year in 2024, we're excited to bring Sport Beach back. And as we say, do it bigger, better, and hopefully bolder.
Well, I love that you call it appointment viewing, because I don't think I've ever heard it called that before, but that's exactly right. There's nothing else that we, well, I guess, I mean, if you're dying to see a political conversation, because the debates aren't happening anymore, but that kind of thing, I guess, would be appointment. But the one that people are really dying to get to, right? They want to see their team do well. They want to participate in the Super Bowl, the Wimbledon, whatever it is, sort of it crosses all interests all the way across the board. There is a specific time that people sit and watch and pay attention. And marketing too for that has really changed and evolved over time. I'm sure you guys have done a lot of research into what it is people are looking for in that area as well. Is that right?
We have, and we're so lucky at Stagwell to have both primary researchers at National Research Group and at the Harris Poll who produce interesting, differentiated research. For example, looking at the impact of live sport viewing versus, you know, if you catch up later, how that impacts the fan experience, how brands can ride different waves, what's Gen Z interested in. What are even younger people like my daughters who are 6 and 9 and very excited about the NCAA women's basketball tournament right now. But we're super lucky to have amazing research on the subject. And one of the things that we know across our research companies is that people who tune into sports have a higher positive brand affinity with the brands who show up in authentic ways at those sports.
Oh, interesting.
Not just slapping your logo on it. Not just, you know, presenting the halftime show, although that can be great, but the amazing brands that lean into the power of sport and the power of what athletes are doing really has a beneficial impact on those brands and on the purchasing power, purchasing intent of people who engage with them.
I love that so much. And I feel like that has become even more of what everyone is really sort of seeking out in their, whether it's their marketing, it's their advertising, it's their messaging, that authenticity really, really has to shine through in a way that it really hits in a way that people identify and understand it and don't, it doesn't feel like it's just sort of, it's done because it's what the numbers told them to do. And I love that you say that that's part of the research because that excites me.
I mean, authenticity is something that's obviously very hard to achieve. It either is there or isn't. My dad said you can't be really unique. It either is unique or it isn't. And athletes have those authentic moments where you take the shot or you shoot the goal, and then you have the moment of success or failure, and it's right there. And we are all experiencing it with you in real time. The thing that I love about events and the thing that I think is super clarifying about events, Sport Beach being one of them, but a basketball game, you know, it's an event as well. It's actually just like an election. It happens on a specific day. You announce what day it's happening. You count it down. And then you can tell who won. You know, you can tell, did people come? Did people talk about it? Did it make news? And that's why I think events are clarifying. They are authenticating and they're really interesting for brand marketers. And it all, you know, it's an election for a brand.
Yeah, absolutely. Talk to me, if you will, a little bit about trends in marketing. This is obviously one in the event space, but I always find that yourself and the people that you consider to be colleagues and counterparts in this space are always really looking for, much as probably like Sport Beach, you would consider, are looking for other opportunities, ways to be innovative and thoughtful and capture people in a place where maybe they weren't expecting to be captured.
I mean, trends in marketing is a relatively big topic.
Yeah, sure.
One of the things that we are seeing is an increasing number of publications and brands working together on innovative content formats. That's not different, but the kind of content and the flexibility of brands and some publications to create new kinds of content, I think is really interesting and exciting. The printed word will always be there. But think about New York Times Games, for example. That is absolutely not something that I think 5 years ago people would have predicted was going to be a huge draw for the New York Times, for brand marketers, for increasing engagement with sure. the Times.
Yeah, great
I
mean, point.
I do my Wordle every day, as do many. Mm-hmm. I also think another trend that's really important is thinking about how your message is going to travel globally, not from a, I need to communicate to this audience in one way and this audience in another way. That's table stakes. But think about what Netflix and Drive to Survive did for F1. That was not intended to be an F1 commercial. It just turned into one and really changed the trajectory of how F1 is viewed around the world. And so you have a brand, F1, taking a new format, a Netflix documentary, and working together to drive interest in it in a really smart, thoughtful way. I think that's a trend that now most marketers are chasing.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, I love that too. And it's something that you don't even think about as it's sort of, but it becomes more interesting. You want to follow it. You want to learn more about it. And it's definitely, I think you're seeing it everywhere. You're seeing it with, you know, brand integration, whether it's the things you can find at your local chain, whatever that right. also happens to be branded by someone who's also a big fashion designer, et cetera, et cetera. There's so mm-hmm. much of that sort of integration. And that's so interesting to me. So you have two younger daughters. What kinds of things do you think? I'm always curious because my kids are just a little bit older than yours, but they're in that teenage space where they're consuming mm-hmm. a lot of information all the time. And I right. find that they, as you said earlier, you said Gen X and other generations are in mm-hmm. they're ingesting this information and this content in a way that's different than perhaps you and I. What are you seeing in that younger generation you think that is working that maybe is interesting to you?
Yeah. So I'll give you two good things and then maybe two could be cautionary tales.
Okay.
So my kids are incredibly comfortable with technology. Mm-hmm. They can't type on a keyboard to save their lives, but you know, they can figure out almost anything that they want to with technology. And I think that on the upside, there is no fear factor for them. Like they're not scared of being able to make the remote work or the device do what they want it to do. And I actually think that's really freeing. If I look at people sort of my age and above, I think there is a fear factor with, can I make the technology work?
Absolutely.
And my kids don't have that. You know, the downside is they have no fear of it and they therefore are not thinking about, do I want to, you know, put X, Y, or Z picture or comment? I police my kids'
we all
screen
have
time
to.
Pretty carefully. Mm-hmm. One of the other sort of form factors, but I think drives content creation and engagement. My children don't know what a non-touch screen is.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that you would have a screen that isn't fully manipulatable, scroll, pinch, drag, drop, that is their default. And I think that's really important as marketers and creators, because that is the expectation for your content. And so that means you need to think about how it moves through the world when you are not the only determiner of the form factor that it will get engaged with.
Mm-hmm.
Another good thing, I think, is that my kids have no boundaries in terms of the languages and the kinds of content they can access. They can read a map. They understand that.
Yes.
But they just have access to content that they wouldn't have access to. And I will not give you on the downside the boring, like they have access they shouldn't have content to,
mm-hmm.
or content they shouldn't have access to. I think everyone knows that. But they also, and I do worry a little bit about this, not to be old, but they don't need to write in the way that I needed to write
mm-hmm.
or in the way you needed to write.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe they'll grow into that. They're only 6 and 9,
yeah.
but that is such a valuable skill and it's incredibly hard to teach. And so I see my kids doing amazing, manipulatable, fun things with technology. And then I can sort of think to myself, oh, but can we write about it?
Mm-hmm.
Could you write an essay about what you just watched?
Right.
I mean, not for the 6-year-old, one step at a time,
right?
But it's something in the back of my mind.
On a previous episode, I hosted Emily Hanford, who hosts a podcast called Share a Story. And it's about sort of the change in the way we teach and the way that kids are learning about reading and writing and all of the other sort of fundamentals about that. And technology is a big piece of that. So that's very interesting, because I'm actually, one of them is graduating, one of them is just 2 years behind. So also too, a fear as well. Like, have we taught them enough? Are they ready to go on to that sort of independent space where mom and dad aren't around to sort of say, how did that go and how did that get written? So I think that that's interesting too. But I'm curious also because as a marketer, so much of what is marketing in general is not just to investors and to big businesses, but also there is that need and that want to communicate and capture that early audience that very well could be lifelong consumers or, you know, brand loyal consumers of what it is ever that you're sharing. And so I think that that's a big piece of it. So I'm always curious about how that, it's not so much the work that you're working in, but you have little people at home. And as a marketer, you sort of look through these things in a lens that's maybe different from others.
I think that's true. I think what I mostly see with my kids is they are suggestible, and that is good and that is bad. If, you know, I'm trying to get them excited about sports, not because of Sport Beach, but just because I think it's good for girls to play sport. And the more I'm excited about it, the more they're excited about it. And on the upside, if they're really excited about slime, which is my 9-year-old's current obsession, like, she can do slime all day.
That's right.
I think it, I think in politics and in marketing, we forget that people are so suggestible sometimes because we're so close. It's like, how do I move that 1%, or how do I get this group, you know, to move from here to here? There's a reason we communicate. Like, it actually does work. My kids are suggestible. So are our consumers. And I think that's, sometimes you have to go back to the young ones to remember those easy lessons.
Yeah. And I also think too, as much as we're trying to capture, not we, but the sort of the collective, we are trying to capture those smaller and younger audiences. There also too is a very suggestible audience in all of what we do in politics, whether it's, on the Republican side or the Democrat side. There are all of these pieces that are sort of happening, and not only on the political part, in the political parts, but also in those policy spaces. So super interesting. Talk to me a little, Beth, about, I've talked to Mark Penn earlier as a guest a couple months back, and he was fantastic and gave us kind of a big umbrella overview of Stagwell. But before we get onto sort of and get to the end of our conversation, I'm curious if you can give me sort of a point of view as the chief brand and communications officer for the company. Talk to me a little bit about what that role entails and how that what that looks like for you beyond Sport Beach and this project that's coming up in June.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to do that. I can talk about Sport Beach as my third child all the time, but it really is just a part of what the team here works on. So in simplest terms, Stagwell is the challenger marketing network, and we are here to transform marketing. We have about 13,000 people around the world engaged in all forms of marketing, advertising, and increasingly business transformation. So what does that mean? It means that anything a CMO would buy, we should have a transformative and cutting edge solution. Awesome. And that could be things that are super close to politics. For example, our risk and reputation unit that helps companies navigate sort of the polarization of brands and the fact that they're being asked to weigh in as brands on political issues they may or may not intend to, all the way through to websites, apps, influencer campaigns, and even more than that, through to what us old people would call traditional advertising, but it still moves the needle and is still incredibly important. And so Stagwell really across, you know, the globe now has the ability to help marketers solve their problems, use marketing to transform businesses, and do it in a smart and digital first way.
And that's, and I've said it before, and I'll say it to you too. I love how each and every one of those organizations within and underneath the Stagwell brand each have their own sort of specific reputation and way that they do their work in sort of a remarkable way. And it's neat that they can, that CMOs can come to you and say, this is what we're looking for, and you can help them solve that, you can give them solutions that are in line with what it is they're looking for.
That is absolutely the intent. A holding company is not a new idea. One of the things that we see at Stagwell is that brand marketers want to work with the best of the best. If you want a website made, you want to work with Code and Theory. If you want a piece of research done, you want to work with National Research Group. You know, if you want some PR, you want to work with Allison. And so we are, I think, differently than some others, focused on making sure our individual agencies have super strong independent cultures, and that what we prioritize from center is collaboration. Mm-hmm. So we are not mushing agencies together. That doesn't work. It produces agencies without differentiation.
That's right.
Instead, we are focused on strong agency cultures and incentivizing collaboration in ways that produces better outcomes for marketers.
I love that. And I think that I really think it's working. And I really, from the outside looking in, it really looks like you guys are having a lot of fun doing it too, which is
great. We are having fun. Yeah. This has been fun, right?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I wish you all the best with Sport Beach this year. I know it's coming up and it's going to be exciting. June will be here in a minute.
75 days.
Yeah. And I'm sure you all have a calendar going. Beth, before I let you go today, I always ask for a recommendation for a future guest. Who do you think I should talk to next?
There are so many talented people in Washington, D.C. doing really interesting things. So I struggled a little to come up with an idea. Thank you for warning me on the question. But I will say Mickey King, who has just taken on a new role as, I think, the managing director for news partnerships at Google. She was a colleague at Politico. I've known her a long time. Then she was at the Washington Post, and really, I think, a great fit sort of at the mix of politics and news and technology.
Amazing.
And I think you'll really enjoy talking with her.
Oh, that's amazing. Well, I'm going to tell her you nominated her. Thank you. Thank you for that. I appreciate it so much. Beth, thanks so much for your time today. It was really a pleasure to have you.
Thank you, Lisa. Appreciate it.
Well, there you have it. Another episode of the Friday Reporter podcast. Thanks so much for tuning in. I love having this show. I love you to be part of it. Thanks again. Thanks to PR Daily for being a partner. And thanks to the folks at Big Wig Podcast for letting us be part of their network. See you soon.